I feel that I bring analytic love and receive love from my clients in abundance, and that that is very much a part of the necessary frame for the work that we do. And by frame, I do mean analytic frame as well as the frame of relatedness.
Welcome to the IPA podcast, Psychoanalysis on and off the couch. This is a podcast in which we will discover the world of psychoanalysis that lives beyond the couch, beyond the individual consultation room. We will meet psychoanalysts who work in dialysis units, prenatal clinics, corporate boardrooms, community centers, humanitarian organizations, and with vineyard workers, just to name a few. We hope these conversations expand our awareness of how broadly psychoanalytic thinking extends into our communities. Come listen, enjoy, and please share your comments on the webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org. Welcome to today's podcast. I'm Harvey Schwartz. I'm a psychoanalyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York and the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia. My guest today is Dr. Linda Emanuel. Dr. Emanuel began her professional career as an internist working with patients who were dying in the early field of palliative care medicine. She then did her training at the Chicago Institute for Psychoanalysis and became an analyst who continued to provide psychodynamic therapy and analysis for palliative care patients and their families. And in her work, she discovered a concept that we will discuss today called existential maturity. I hope you have the experience listening to this, as I did in conducting it, that we all have faced illness in ourselves and in loved ones. And most all of us have faced death in people we're close to. And one can only hope that the people who care for our loved ones and for eventually ourselves will have the existential maturity that we learn about in today's interview with Dr. Emanuel. I hope you enjoy it. Linda, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
In anticipation of our speaking today, I tried to locate a reference I had come across some years ago, and it was of a former patient of Freud's who was on his deathbed and asked to see Freud to thank him for the work they had done. And Freud did go meet him in the hospital. And the patient wanted to thank him because he felt that their analytic work that they had done together was so profound, not only in how he lived his life, but now as he was facing his death with an equanimity that he always valued. And he wanted to express that appreciation to Freud. And in my looking for the reference, I finally realized that I needn't go back 100 years and I needn't go back to Freud to recognize that profound analytic work impacts not only how people live their lives, but for all of us, how we face our deaths. And this is something you've done as a life's work. You've helped people face their deaths. And you've done it rather uniquely. You've done it as an internist, and then you've done it as a psychoanalyst. So you have much to teach us about the mindsets of each. I'm assuming they're different, and what the transition has been like for you in encountering people in such positions. Tell us about your work. Tell us about the patients you see, the kinds of engagements you have with patients, and in particular, this term of yours, existential maturity, which, as I've read what you've written, really seems to bring together the essence of what you understand about someone facing death. And the existential maturity applies, of course, not only to the person who's dying, but to the person who's trying to serve as a guide to the dying person.
Well, I'll do my best. It's an enormously elusive thing that we are talking about. And thank you for raising that example of the person who felt that his analysis was helpful, because I have been trying to provide some of that help for patients who are actively grappling with their own mortality or the mortality of a loved one for some time, believing that it's possible, finding that for some it's possible, and having observed a tremendous difference in people from very early on when I went into the field of end-of-life care. There was no specialty of palliative medicine back then when I went into this area. But there was a phenomenon, and it was a very real phenomenon that I found extremely distressing, which was that in medicine writ large, culturally, we, the providers, were very poor at providing what people needed as they faced their death, so that people who were considered quote-unquote incurable were very often found in the hospital, as distinct from at home, where most of them would have preferred to be, at the far end of the hallway, the furthest from the nurse's station, rarely visited by medical staff. And when they were asking questions about what they should do, they would get something of an answer along the lines of, well, I don't know what I would do, Mrs. Jones, because I'm not you. And I found that tremendously distressing on behalf of the patients, and distressing because of my own profession being apparently not equipped to be there with people as they were facing their death, unlike any of the other medical events that might befall them, where my colleagues were fantastic at being there. So what was this about? I got distressed enough about it to go into the area and discovered one major thing that just held me to the inquiry and held me to the engagement. And that was that some people facing their death had this kind of equanimity. I love that word. It was a kind of reconciliation, a kind of integration, a kind of peace of mind, a disposition of connection and love that was really inspiring and, I think, for many people, enviable. It was a phenomenon that many people noticed, and most people even today, I think, who have gone into palliative and end-of-life care in medicine say that they just find it inspiring to be with people who are facing their dying in this manner. But it wasn't everybody by any stretch. There were people who suffered enormously and died suffering, and I wanted to know what made it possible for some people to have that kind of sense of maturity, that sense of equanimity and a quality of life that people in the gathering field began to term a good death or a quality of dying. And people in the field began to try and create measures for it. And so there were a lot of people who were interested in this, but nobody could really put their finger on what were the components of it. What was it? Who gets there? Who doesn't? Because this state seemed to have an enormous impact on the people who were left behind as well. To see a loved one dying with equanimity seemed to allow people to grieve in a way that allowed them to move on in a healthy way and to complete loving relationships moving forward, whereas those who didn't have that seemed to have a lasting, what in the field of medicine we called complicated grief. And I don't know that that has been studied enough to say it's a tight correlation. I think it has not. But that was my observation. So it seemed very, very important to understand what this thing was. This is sort of the elusive elixir that we all want.
And the likely too glib notion is the phrase, people die as they lived. That sounds, from what you're saying, rather incomplete.
Incomplete, but as many glib statements that are popular, does go to the nubbin of something. And One of the things that I've been very intrigued by and compelled to engage more by is something that has come forward since I've been doing dynamic and analytic work with patients who are dying and their family members. And that is the notion that the way in which they have their own particular attachment style, something we think about in analysis as an important phenomenon, seems to be quite relevant, if not determinative, of how they face their dying. And so I have ended up doing a good deal of work around the origins of their attachment style as part of analytic work with people, in most cases now family members, because people who are in palliative care don't have long enough to do analytic work in many cases. But I've ended up finding that that has been the active work that comes up in the normal manner of normal analytic work, and it helps them with their grief. And it's even maybe a necessary condition for being able to grieve, to engage that aspect of themselves. So that may go along with the glib notion of people die as they live.
Let me extend that just a bit. I had a conversation with Bob Waldinger, who heads the Harvard Adult Development Research. And his research has found that you can trace the level of intimacy that married couples have in their 80s to the nature of their childhood attachments and affections, which, as he noted in his interview, said that on the one hand, for psychoanalysts, isn't surprising, but to document it empirically is profound and important. Are you sort of saying the same thing, that early attachments is a thread that continues throughout our lives, and you're adding to how we deal with death?
I think so. And of course, the chicken and egg question will come up for this round of the conversation, as well as for prior rounds of the conversation. Is the interaction between infant and parent figure determinative, or also influenced by the same inherent factors, or almost certainly both? So I think it's important to document. It's important to understand how those similarities do and do not play out. The way in which I'm trying to contribute to that is, along with some colleagues, to collect a series of cases of patients who are from the palliative care context and their family members who are receiving dynamic therapy and or psychoanalytic work. And so our hope, we have a couple of very small grants, but that's all we need, to collect these cases and discuss them and publish them. So I'm hoping that that will provide something for us.
It's very promising, yes. I want to ask you a question, and I feel atypically uncomfortable in asking it. And it has to do with the subject of love. We humans, certainly when you get to be of a certain age, have had either one's own experience with being seriously ill, or have certainly been very close to people who have been seriously ill, and often enough have been close to people who have died. And it is a common experience that immediately what's called up from us humans, from all of us, are feelings and expressions of love. For people who have not used the words in decades, when someone close to them can be seriously ill or seriously injured in an accident, for example, the automatic notion, which seems to me must be hardwired somewhere, is to speak of love, to surround the person with love, to offer love. And you've mentioned it even already today a few times about the presence of love in these occasions. Can you shed some light on it? I guess my hesitation is because it's awkward to ask for a clinical impression of the role of love, but that is what I'm asking. And in particular, not only how the patients you deal with who are dying relate to being loved and loving themselves, but also how you as a practitioner both are the recipient of their love, of appreciation for what you offer them, and how love is called up from within you towards your patients as part of your engagement with them.
Yes, I think your question is absolutely the right question. And it, of course, connects to what we were just saying about attachment, because attachment is so much about love and the nature of love. I think it also connects with the Freudian concept of analytic love. To your question about what it feels like to me professionally to bring whatever I bring and receive whatever I receive, I feel that I bring analytic love and receive love from my clients in abundance, and that is very much a part of the necessary frame for the work that we do. And by frame, I do mean analytic frame, as well as the frame of relatedness that might more ordinarily be termed love. Now, love is a word that I sort of hate, actually, because it's so encompassing, and it can be understood in so many different ways, and it's a source of so much misunderstanding because of its complexity. But if we understand love as analytic love and in the context in which we're talking now, I'm very comfortable with that. To expand on that a little further, I think we can understand that love as the holding environment, the analytic frame, and all of the components of hovering, even attention, and finding the person where they're at, and the empathic understanding of a cohesion nature, and all of those things that we know so well from the analytic frame. That seems to be what allows people to progress through their grief in a manner that we might call healthy and healing. That seems to be what allows people to face their death as well as they possibly can. They respond in love. Ira Byock, as a leader from the palliative care movement, one of his early thought leaders, and he wrote a book in which he made it clear that over the many, many patients he had worked with, he found that there were very few and all essential things that people wanted and benefited from saying and from hearing when a person was dying. And it came down to, I love you, I forgive you, do you forgive me? And I'm going to stop there because we're focused on the love part. And so I think this notion of love seen from the perspective of the person who's dying and losing someone is about a kind of vital connection that allows some sense of in being invested in. And that's an important term because it connects to what is entailed in grief later for those who are bereaved, being connected to one another. And what that gives the dying person is some sense of continuity. They're connected with those who are left behind. And what that gives the person who is about to be left behind is what they need to accomplish the internalization of grief that Freud talked about in Mourning and Melancholia.
The way you phrase it in one of your papers is you say, love can make staring at mortality bearable.
Yes. And I think that is just a sort of experiential expression of what I just tried to be a bit more analytic or intellectual about just now.
Yes. Perhaps segueing from love, but central to it, is analytic love, as you say. You've had a journey. You've had a journey from being an internist to being a psychoanalyst, and fascinatingly have continued to do the same work with both mindsets. And again, I'm assuming different mindsets. Can you tell us something about that journey and what the transition has been like for you?
So my personal journey in this field, I think, started in the same way that every other person's personal journey might start. In this case, mine we can focus on the journey that is about relating to mortality. My grandfather died when I was very little. I don't remember him at all, but I do remember the pain on my father's face when my grandfather died. Then my grandmother died, and I remember her passing very clearly because I was part of the caregiving team. We would bathe her and toilet her, and as a very young person, that was that left a big impression on me. But I was not injured emotionally when she died. It was a comfortable feeling of sadness. My next encounter with mortality was losing a pregnancy, which was enormously painful to my core self. And I saw a very profound difference between types of loss, whether they involved my core self or something that was still intact and central to me. So that became my personal perspective as I went into medicine and then discovered this, what I found, dehumanizing treatment of people who were dying at a time when their only salve was to be treated as very, very human, i.e. loved by another human, and love, their love received by another human. And so I went into the field with the thought that something needed to be done about it. It was around the time of Cicely Saunders having just achieved some of the strength of her work in putting the hospice and palliative care movement on the map. And I stayed in that field for decades until it had become a specialty and within medicine. And I really felt that there were people who were doing magnificent work, and I began to feel redundant and mostly still interested in what is this thing that allows some people to die with a tremendous quality of life and a quality of dying, and had begun to despair of being able to do research in the area in the traditional medical context. I'd spent my career as an academic physician getting grants on palliative and end-of-life care, mostly to do with education, but I could not get one on existential maturity. They wouldn't fund them. So I decided I needed to go back to where all of medicine begins, which is at the clinical encounter with people who are at the cliff face. So I decided to train as a psychoanalyst at the Chicago Institute and began to provide this kind of care at the supportive oncology unit at Northwestern Memorial, which I'm still doing. So that was how I got into this particular aspect of psychoanalytic work and that particular aspect of work with the dying.
Can you identify a change in your mindset working from when you were an internist to when you were an analyst working with dying patients?
Well, I can identify a difference and a commonality in that when I went into medicine, it was with the hope that there would be a combining of the scientific approach with a humane-centered ethos. And I was distressed to find that that wasn't really the case. We were sort of splicing and dicing people into diagnoses and organ systems in medicine. So that's what sent me into the efforts that I was engaged in. And then when I started in the psychoanalytic field, I felt that, well, here we are. This is where we can really get to the depths of what allows people to live and die in certain ways, only to find that actually we're not very good at facing our own mortality in our fields either. And Freud had himself had a very difficult time with mortality, as did some of the other leaders of the different schools in analysis. So it was a paradoxical kind of thing. On the one hand, I feel very strongly that psychoanalysis does have the tools to understand this, and it can be used, as the case for the historical patient who you describe, and absolutely seems to be the case with some of the patients who I'm working with, or each in their own way, all the patients I'm working with, they do seem, it's very similar to termination in a normal analysis that doesn't have anything to do with illness-related mortality. When a person is dealing with their mortality, they go through the phases of termination in a way that has really caused me to scratch my head and think. There's an enormous amount more to be understood that I don't understand at all, but we're beginning. And I think that one major thing that continues to impress me is that, so in the field of palliative care, there's a sort of adage that people say that patients repeatedly comment that they're not afraid of death, they're afraid of dying. And the equivalent has come up in work with my patients who are facing their dying. And I think it goes back to the attachment theory and what we were talking about at the beginning. People are very uncomfortable with those feelings of fragmentation, those feelings of falling, being disconnected, being abandoned, things that come up as a critical component of attachment patterns and that come up again in their facing dying. So back to love, right? These are all feelings of the opposite of love when stated in negative, and the feeling of internal cohesiveness. We can think of individuation as well. We can think of that kind of self-psychology sense of maturity, of wholeness. And so that's why I still use the term existential maturity, because it does seem to arrive for people as part of a process. And the process is very different depending on their attachment style, but they can arrive at a sense of internal cohesiveness as they're dying and as they're grieving in their own particular way. So it does seem to be related to the mechanisms of human development. And it does seem to be related to something highly existential, you know, in the Kleinian sense of, which I understand the Kleinian sense is not entirely existential, but the way I use that notion of going from a state of apoplexy that a baby can go from into a state of, you know, the depressive position, or being cradled and comfortable in a parent's arms, I think of that as an existential experience on the part of the infant, that the parent knowingly or unwittingly provides for. And we carry on oscillating through that throughout our life. So as we face the end of our life, it's quite obviously existential all over again. And there is a capacity to face it in a mature manner or in a much more fragmented and incomplete manner. But we oscillate nonetheless, and we get there however far we can get with it. In our own imperfect ways, the better for having a holding environment or an analytic frame equivalent.
In our own imperfect ways, right? Can you describe a patient for us, an individual you've worked with, and the nature of the encounter between the two of you that will bring these thoughts to clinical life and immediacy?
Well, if I can mention two, because the contrast I think is helpful, or it has been to me anyway. One is of a person who was facing the loss of her husband and had a tremendously difficult time. This person had an extremely difficult childhood, and the attachment style was one of great anxiety and great ambivalence. And working with that person through the dying and through the bereavement period was very much like working with anxious attachment. But we did that work in the way that we would do work with somebody with anxious attachment that was not in the same context. And that person did come through to an equanimity of their own variety that allowed moving forward and being interested in creating a new life and repartnering. So that's one patient. Another patient is an older man who had a diagnosis of a non-threatening diagnosis of cancer, prostate cancer, but the cancer triggered a engagement of a kind that was quite interesting. This person had been analyzed twice before. First analysis was critical in that this person had also had a very difficult childhood, but with a positive relationship with the mother. And the first analysis was a very profound, healing, life-saving analysis that allowed this person to marry and have children and have a productive, intact family that's still intact and loving. Second analysis occurred when one of those children was having trouble and sort of completed some of that early work. But now this man was feeling very uncomfortable. The second analysis had been ended because the analyst had passed away and termination had not been completed. So this person was really very interested in his own mortality and in completing the termination that hadn't happened with the second analysis. Both of these people arrived at a place that they desperately wanted to arrive at emotionally and relationally, but from very different places. I think the second one had a very solid attachment style and a profound ability to love despite the difficult childhood because of the strong relationship with the mother and the strong analyses. The first person did not, but both of them managed in an analytic setting to oscillate their way through to their own form of existential maturity.
Rich and lovely examples. Linda, one can't help but wonder about you. It's an odd way to say it, I guess. This work is so unique and asks so deeply of someone, and so few people in our field immerse themselves in it as you have. Can you share something about yourself that will help someone learning about you and this work for the first time get a fuller picture of who you are?
Well, that's an interesting question. I don't think of myself in those terms, so I'm not quite sure what to share. I would so welcome more people being interested in this area and the idea of collecting more cases because more people were interested. It would be absolutely wonderful.
Well, we'll see the results of this interview and maybe you'll get your wish.
Yeah. I don't know really what to share, except that I'd be delighted to share anything because it would be so marvelous to have the more colleagues in this field, the better.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for not only spending time with us and for sharing with us, but for introducing me to you, your work, your writings. I'm confident that those listeners will also take to your message, and it's the message of thoughtful tenderness, really tuning in to a patient's experience, both as a clinician and as a loving human being. And as you have put your two fields together, you have struggled to find the sweet spot, which is elusive for all of us, of course, that perfect place or that idealized place where we can both be a scientist and a loving human being in trying to heal people. But you're coming awfully close to that, and I'm grateful for learning from you.
Well, thank you. What tender, beautiful things to say. I'm feeling a little embarrassed, but thank you so much.
I apologize for that, but I think that's my truth in encountering you. So thank you so much for sharing today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes
or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.